Okay, so we are holding on Lamed Hey Omud Beis, 8 lines from the bottom, line begins to show you. We left off on the discussion. We said that there are they would blow six shofar sounds before Shabbos to tell people that it's time to stop work. We had a couple of different opinions how exactly it worked. The last thing we said was that they would blow a tia through a tia, and that's it. Shabbos has begun. So now, continuing on that subject, Amar Rav Yosi ber Chanina Shamaisi, he says, I heard from my rabbeim shein bo lahavlik after shesh tkiyas madlik. But actually, a person could still light Shabbos candles even after the sixth sound. Now, like this we were saying before, we had Rav Nosson saying that the third sound is the one that's supposed to signal people that it's time to light Shabbos candles. We have Rav Yehuda Nosson saying the fourth. We brought a version of the Braita that said the second one is to light the candles, but we said that's not correct. It's the third one. But whatever it is, so now Rav Yosi ber Chanina is saying that actually you could even light Shabbos candles even after the sixth one. It's not quite Shabbos yet when you blow the sixth one, he says. Because after all, he says, the Chachamim had to allow a certain amount of time for the Chazan HaKnesses, meaning the Shamash, to take the shofar home. Now, the guy wouldn't be standing on top of his own roof necessarily to blow shofar because you need a tall roof for that so that the sound will be able to be heard all over the city, just like nowadays you have the siren is, just like nowadays, for example, you have the siren on top of a very tall thing on top of Chevra Shas in the middle of Crown Heights. So the same idea, in other words, you would need that the roof that he's blowing from is a tall roof. It's not necessarily his own. So what would happen? So at the end, when he's finished blowing, he would have to take the shofar home, and the Chachamim would allow him time to. Now, there isn't necessarily an Eruv in town, but obviously, therefore, says Rav Yosi ber Chanina, it must be that Shabbos hasn't quite begun yet when he finishes blowing shofar, because there has to be enough time for him to take the shofar back home. Amar Loi, but the Chachamim said to him, "In Kain Nasatid Varecha L'Shiurim." If you're going to say that, then it's not always a fixed amount of time, because depending where the Shamash lives, relative to where he's blowing shofar from, it might be a minute, it might be 2 minutes, it might be 5 minutes, it might be, depends how far he lives. The Chachamim don't make such takanas. When the Chachamim make a takana, they make it uniform. Ella said no. They say to him, "You're not right. You're not correct. You're not correct in saying that there must be enough time for him to take the shofar home, and therefore that implies that when he's done blowing, it's not quite Shabbos yet." No. Ella mokum tanur yeshle lachazan aknesis v'rosh gadoi. Rather, what they did is they had a set aside area on the top of the same roof where the chazan aknesis is blowing the shofar. They had a hidden away place over there, a box or something, and there we could put the shofar in there. So in other words, you're thinking that he has to actually have time to carry home the shofar. He doesn't. As soon as he's finished blowing, Shabbos has begun. What does he do as far as to keep the shofar safe? They have a box or something over there to put it into. And the reason is the Braisa continues, Fisha in the Taltul and Loyas a shofar, Veloyas a Hatsotis. Because you should know that you're not allowed to on Shabbos, you're not allowed to move a shofar, and you're not also not allowed to move chatzotzos, which are trumpets. A shofar is curved, trumpets are straight. So therefore, so that's it. So they can't carry the shofar on Shabbos, so he has to have, so both Rav Yosi and Rav Chanina and the Chachamim do agree with that point. This Rav Yosi and Rav Chanina says that they would have to allow him enough time to carry it home, and therefore he says that obviously indicates that Shabbos hasn't quite begun yet. And the Chachamim counter that no, the Shabbos has already begun. He just puts it away in some hidden area over there on the roof. Okay. So the question is, so you're telling me you have a braisa that says that you're not allowed to move a shofar or chatzotzeret on Shabbos. V'atanya, but we were in another braisa, shofar mitalto, v'chatzotzeret enim mitaltoin. That no, a different braisa says that no, you're allowed to move a shofar on Shabbos, but you're not allowed to move chatzotzeret. Loikasha, there's no contradiction. Can be yochid, can be tzibur. The difference would be whether you're talking about an individual or whether you're talking about the tzibur. In other words, he's saying that now when you get down to it, a shofar has a use on Shabbos. A shofar, as the Gemara is going to say in a second, you can use it as sort of like a makeshift baby bottle. If you have a little kid who's not capable of drinking from a cup yet, you can pour some water into the wide end of the shofar, and you can pour some water into whatever drink into the wide end of the shofar, and then they can drink it drop by drop out of the narrow end. So therefore, as opposed to a chatzotzis, it's not like that. A chatzotzis being a straight thing, you can't really do like that, because if you pour liquid in the one end, it's going to come right out the other end. There's no real way to hold it to prevent it from coming out the other end right away. And the whole point is you want to be able to hold it in a way that the kid will only get a little bit of it at a time. So that's the thing. So if we say, so by an individual, we would say that they can use it to feed their baby, and by the kid, or not. So the question is, Omalei Abaya. So Abaya asks Rabbi Yosef, what's the difference? Over Yochid B'Maicha. After all, what are you going to say that by a Yochid, by an individual, you would say they could use a shofar on Shabbos? Because you're saying you can use it to give a baby to drink. You pour something into the wide end, and then you hold it. You tilt it this way or that, so that the baby only gets a little bit at a time. Well then, you could say the same thing about the tzibur. They can use it in case if there's a kid in town who's poor, at let's say, for example, a yosem or something, where the tzibur is raising him, same thing. Then they can use a shofar in the same way to feed him, the same way as an individual could for their baby, the same way the tzibur could for a baby that they're raising. So why should there be a difference between a yochid and a tzibur? The two, and furthermore, continues Abaya, if you're going to say that the difference between the two brises so far is that one's talking about a yochid and one's talking about a sibur, and you're going to say, therefore, the yochid can move a shofar on Shabbos and the sibur can't, what about ha-detanya? What about you have a third brisa? Kishem shematalpun as a shofar, kashmatalpun as a chatzotzis. You have another brisa that says that just as you're allowed to move a shofar on Shabbos, you're allowed to move a chatzotzis. So what is it? Money. Who would that be according to? Why would there be a difference? Then what would you say? The chassotis apparently don't have any real use on Shabbos other than to blow them and make a sound, but obviously you can't do that on Shabbos. So Abaya is saying, why would you have three different brises? One that says that neither one is mukta, one that says that both of them are mukta, and one that says that only a shofar is mukta and a chassotis is not. So it can't be a difference. It can't be a difference of whether we're talking yochid or tzibur, because then that doesn't explain a third brisa. Ela loy kasha. So rather, says Abaye, there's no contradiction between the three brises. Ha Rav Yehuda, ha Rav Shimon, ha Rav Nechemya. You have three different opinions when it comes to mukta. Now we've learned before about two of them. We've talked about Rav Yehuda and Rav Shimon. We said that there's a number of machlokes and hilchos Shabbos that Rav Yehuda and Rav Shimon have. One of them we talked about earlier is about mukta, where Rabbi Yehuda has a much broader, that we talked about earlier in our parrot, that Rabbi Yehuda has a much broader definition of mukta than Rabbi Shimon does. And therefore, so Rashi explains like this. The price of it said that the shofar, and on the other hand, Rabbi Shimon has a very narrow definition. And Rabbi Nechemya has the broadest definition of mukta at all. So let's first understand how Rashi says. Rashi explains like this. The brisa that says that the brisa that distinguishes between the shofar and the chatzotzeret, that would be according to Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda would actually say, Rashi learns, that the shofar is actually, that at least the way Tosfos understands, Rashi doesn't spell out in so many words, but Tosfos understands Rashi to be saying that Rabbi Yehuda in effect would say that the shofar is not really mukta on Shabbos. It is a keli because you're able to use it to give a baby a drink. Therefore, so Tosfos understands Rashi to be saying that it's not actually a kli shemalachta le'isur. It would actually be considered a kli shemalachta le'heter, because you can use it for a mutter purpose. Therefore, you're allowed to move it on Shabbos, as opposed to the chatzotzis. There's no function that it has on Shabbos, because again, you can't even use it to give a baby a drink because it's not curved. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda would say that is a kli shemalachta le'isur, and you can't move it on Shabbos. Rav Shimon, who doesn't hold in general of mukta with certain exceptions, he would say that even the chatzotzis you're allowed to move, even though there's no purpose that you can use them for on Shabbos, nevertheless he would allow you to move them. And then we have the opinion of Rav Nechemya, which we're going to talk about in more detail later on in the Masechta, the 17th parak of our Masechta, in the Kukhas, we're going to talk about, as the Shem, we're going to talk about an opinion of the Nehemiah, where he says, even a kli shel, now like this, we normally know, I mean, we all grow up learning, when we learn the halacha of mukta, we learn that, for example, let's say, you have certain items that are not mukta at all, like, for example, dishes are not mukta at all, and therefore you're allowed to move them for whatever purpose you want. Now, we have to realize when it comes to moving things that are mukta, there's a few purposes why you might want to move something that's mukta. You could have what's called tzorach gufay. You want to use the item itself. So, for example, if you're using the shofar to give a baby a drink would be an example of tzorach gufay. You could have where you want to move it because it's in the way. You need the space that it's on for something else. That's called tzorach mekoymos. And then you also have where you could tzorach gufay could be the main purpose of it or not the main purpose, at least the way Rashi is learning it over here. For example, a shofar, the main purpose of a shofar is to blow it, which is something which is also on Shabbos, but you also have a secondary use of it, namely that you can give a baby to drink with it, and therefore that would also be considered a tzorach gufay. You can have a tzorach mekoymo, let's say it's in the way, and then you have what's called mechama l'tzel, which literally means from the sun to the shade. Let's say, imagine, you have, for example, you left something outdoors, and you realize it's Shabbos, and if you leave it outdoors, let's say you leave it in the sun, then it's going to crack from the heat or something, or anything like that. So you're moving it not because you need to use it itself, and not because you need the space where it is, but to protect the thing itself. Now, the
one question. One question.
One time. You know what? Before you ask your question, let's finish the understanding over here of Rav Nechemya's opinion, then ask, okay?
Uh-huh.
So, according to Rav Nechemya, even an item, even a cliche malachte laheker, let's say, for example, a bowl or a spoon or something, Rav Nechemya would say that the only purpose you're allowed to move it for on Shabbos is only for its main purpose. So therefore, it comes out according to him, in other words, according to Tosfos, learns a little bit differently, but according to Rashi, what we're saying is, in other words, that Rav Nechemya would say that even, let's say, for example, dishes or other things that are perfectly mutter to use on Shabbos, obviously you're allowed to eat using a bowl or a spoon on Shabbos, but he would say, on Shabbos, you can only move them for their primary purpose. So let's say, for example, the primary purpose of a bowl is in order to eat out of. Therefore, he would say you would not be allowed to move a bowl on Shabbos, let's say, in order to, you need to put something on, let's say you want to turn it upside down and put something on top of it, or to hold, let's say you're reading by the table and you want to turn over a bowl and use it to hold up a book, Rav Nechemya would say you're not allowed to do that. Rav Nechemya would also say, by the same token, that you're also not allowed to move it with tzorach gufay v'koymo, that you're not allowed to, that you're not allowed to move it from the sun into the shade either, in other words, to protect it. So therefore, in other words, it comes out that according to Rav Nechemya, that's why we would say over here that both the shofar and the chatzotzeret are mukta, because the main purpose of a shofar is to blow with it. The main purpose is not to give a baby a drink with it. And therefore, he says, since in general, any keli you can only move for its primary purpose, and the primary purpose of a shofar you can't do on Shabbos because you're not allowed to blow a shofar, therefore, that's it. Then therefore you wouldn't be allowed to move either the shofar, let alone the chatzotzeret, because the chatzotzeret are straight, and you can't even use it for any other purpose other than its primary purpose. Whereas again, Rav Yehuda would hold that, Rav Yehuda, according to Rashi over here, who's learning, the way Tosfos understands Rashi, that a shofar is a kli shel malachta laheter, so Rav Yehuda would say, fine, you're allowed to move that in order to give a baby a drink with it, but not the chatzotzeret. And Rav Shimon, who has a very narrow definition of mukta, would say that either one is fine to move on Shabbos. That's all according to Rashi. Now, according to Tosfos has a different understanding that the shofar is actually considered a kli shel malachta l'isur. Nevertheless, even Rabbi Yehuda, who holds of a wider definition of mukta, would say that a kli shel malachta l'isur, you're allowed to move a third of gufay or a third of makoma. If you need to use the actual keli itself for some secondary purpose, like over here, where a shofar's primary purpose is to blow, but you're using it for a secondary purpose to give a baby a drink, Rabbi Yehuda would hold that that's fine. Rav Shimon would say that I don't even consider it mukta. he would agree, though, that you can't move it mechamel or sale. You can't move it in order to protect it. But he would say that the chasotis also are exactly the same as the shofar. It doesn't matter really whether they have a secondary purpose or not. He would agree you can't move it in order to protect it, mechamel or sale. But he would say that you can move them if you need them for gufoi or for makomoi, and gufoi in the case of a chasotis. Okay, he's not going to need to give a baby to drink, but it could be something else, or it could just be that it's in the way. It's on a chair that you want to sit on, let's say, and then you'd be allowed to move it. And Reb Nechemya, meanwhile, would say that both of them are also, because he would say that you can only move them for their actual purpose. Okay, Tertius also mentions that even according to Reb Nechemya, fine, you would say that maybe at least you would say that Reb Nechemya would say, let's say for example, you ate off a plate, then fine, maybe you'd be allowed to move it afterwards in order to clear the table. Okay, so those are the three opinions. Now, you still want to ask something?
Well, I was about to ask something in the direction of what you're saying on the narrowness or the largeness of the definition. According to Reb Nechemya, it's the prime main purpose of the keli, regardless of its use.
Exactly. So according to him, whether, for example, you're talking about, let's say, a plate, whose primary purpose on Shabbos is for hefter, to eat off of, or whether you're talking about something whose primary purpose is an iser, let's say a hammer or a shofar or what have you, he would say similar rules apply to both of them. You can't move either one of them only for its primary purpose, which therefore the result would be, according to him, that for example, a hammer or a shofar, you can't move on Shabbos for any purpose, because its primary purpose is something which is also, whereas a plate, you can move on Shabbos for its primary purpose in order to eat off of, but not, let's say, for example, to put something on top of it or something.
Okay. Right. So let's say, for example, according to Rav Yechemia, if you use a knife to cut something that's not food, you're chayav, basically.
Not chayav. No. First of all, keep in mind we're talking about mukta over here. The whole concept of mukta is dirabon. There's no chayav in it. But Reb Nechemya would say that yes, that you take a knife, for example, and use it, let's say, to cut, yeah, exactly. Tosfos, in fact, mentions that case over here, that let's say you take a knife and use it on Shabbos, let's say, to cut a rope, then Reb Nechemya would say it's also to do that on Shabbos. Because a knife's primary purpose is not to cut a rope, it's to cut food, right?
But if you want to cut, if you have a package, let's say, that's roped up, containing food, and you have to break the rope to use the meat.
So the halacha is not like Reb Nechemya. The halacha, as we've learned before, is like Reb Shimon when it comes to Shabbos. So you are in fact allowed to open packages of food, but we'll talk about that later on. That's a discussion for later on in the Sefer. So let's continue over here. So the question is, if you're going to say that the last braisa that says both the shofar and the chatzotzis is also on Shabbos, if you're saying that's according to Reb Nechemya, then why does it need to mention both? It could have said, in fact, why does it have it in the order? It says, k'shem shematal, the first braisa, that we said, l'fisha in metalfu, loyas ha-shofar v'loyas ha-chatzotzis. You're not allowed to move a shofar or a chatzotzis. Now, according to Reb Nechemya, there's more of a chiddush with a shofar, given that a shofar has a use that's permissible on Shabbos, whereas a chatzotzis doesn't even. So if that first braisa is a chatzotzis of Nechemya, then why is it phrased like that? You're not allowed to move the shofar or the chatzotzis. It shouldn't have had to mention the chatzotzis at all. In fact, because once you can't move a shofar, obviously you can't move a chatzotzis. So therefore, my shofar nami chatzotzis. In that braisa, we have to say that when it says the word chatzotzis, when it uses the word shofar, it actually refers to a chatzotzis. It actually refers to a trumpet, and it's calling it by the name shofar, which is kidur of chista. In that case, that formulation and that braisa goes like what Rav Chista said. The omen of chista, namely Rav Chista said, there are three things whose names were switched around after the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. And the first one of them is Chatzetarta Shofra, Shofra Chatzetarta. What was called in the time of the Beit HaMikdash Chatzotzis, a trumpet, is nowadays called Shofra. And what was called Shofra in the time of the Beit HaMikdash later on came to be called Chatzotzis. So therefore, when the Braisa said that you're not allowed to move a Shofra or a Chatzotzis, It means the opposite of what we thought. We thought a shofar is the curved one and a hatotzis is the straight one. Now the chisda is telling us that no, actually the braisa means the other way around. Shofar means the straight one, the one that's made out of metal, and chatzotzis means what we think of as a shofar, which comes from the head of an animal. So you should know, Rav Chisda says that those definitions were switched around after the Beis Mikdash was destroyed. So the Gemara says, "L'mai nafkamina." So what's the practical use of knowing that those that they were switched around? Is well, shofar shofar Rosh Hashanah. Very simple. You have to know what to blow and what to listen to on Rosh Hashanah. If you hear somebody, Rashi mentioned we're talking about an Amma Oret. If you hear an Amma Oret saying, not necessarily does he mean an Amma Oret like an uneducated person. He could just mean the regular man on the street or whatever. The point is, if you hear that he's talking about blowing the chatzotzis on Rosh Hashanah, then that's exactly what you need to hear on Rosh Hashanah. Whereas if he talks about blowing the shofar, then that's not the right thing. Or the other thing Rashi says is, let's say a person comes to a rav to ask, it's Rosh Hashanah, I know I'm supposed to be hearing the tkiyah through a tkiyah, etc. What should I be hearing it from, a shofar or a chatzotzis? Now, based on what Rav Chisda is telling him, you have to know to tell him you have to hear a chatzotzis. Otherwise, if you tell him you have to hear a shofar, he's going to end up listening to the wrong thing. The next one, by the way, Rabbi Yaakov Emden has a whole explanation about why these things were changed after the Beis Mikdash was destroyed, this and the next two things. He says the first two things, the shofar, and the next thing we're going to mention, the arava, both of them you have, you had in the Beis Mikdash, they blew both shofar and chatzotzis on Rosh Hashanah and on fast days, and therefore the chachamim actually were the ones who decided that the names should be switched around as a zeichel lemikdash, and so that people are clear of what they should blow, and they shouldn't think that we should be doing like we did in the Beis Mikdash and blowing both shofar and chatzotzis. And he says the same thing as far as the next one, where it talks about arava, because you have two types of arava. You have the aravas that we have as one of the dalim in him, and then you have the aravas that they would put these big, very, very tall aravah branches standing up around the Mizbeach, and then they would walk around the Mizbeach every day with them. So again, for the same idea, that Chachamim wanted to make a Zeichel LeKorban in that to remember that nowadays there's only one kind of aravah. So the next one is aravah Tzatzifa, Tzatzifa aravah. What used to be called an aravah is now called a Tzatzifa, and vice versa, what used to be called Tzatzifa is nowadays an aravah. A tzatzifa, Rashi brings from the Mishnayos and Sukkah, is a species that's related to willows, but instead of having long, skinny leaves like aravas have, instead it has rounder leaves, and the leaves have serrations in them, and the stem being red, it's white. So it's a different species, but vaguely similar to arava. So again, the point is, you have to know. So l'mai nafkamina l'lulav. What's the practical difference? As far as lulav, make sure that nowadays, once the definitions were switched around, make sure that for your dalad minim, you're taking what's nowadays called tzatzifa. Because if you take what's nowadays called arava, then you're going to be getting the wrong thing. And the third one, pasurta. Pasurta means a large table, and pasurta means a small table. So what used to be called a psota, a large table, is now called pasurta, a small table, and vice versa. What used to be called a small table is now called a large table. The practical definition of that is as far as buying and selling. Nowadays, if somebody comes to you, if you agree to sell somebody a pasurta, then you need to make sure you're giving them a large table, and vice versa. So the point is, again, the reason why we're bringing this in is, again, since we had a braisa that mentioned you're not allowed to move a shofar or chatzotzis on Shabbos, and we're saying that's according to the Nechemya, who wouldn't allow you to move either one. So according to him, there's a greater chiddush in a shofar than chatzotzis, because after all, a shofar has a certain use on Shabbos. But we're saying that the definition is switched around, and therefore when he says shofar, he actually means what we think of as a trumpet, and when he says chatzotzis, it's what we think of as a shofar. Amar Abaya, so Abaya says, Af Onu Noimar, there is actually another one that we can say, there's another thing where the definitions have gotten switched around, maybe not necessarily right after the Korban, but there is another pair of things where the original definitions were switched around. Huvlila Beikasi, Beikasi Huvlila. The Huvlila and the Beikasi are two of an animal's four stomachs. We learned back in Kolin that a kosher animal has four stomachs. In particular, here we're dealing with the second and the third one. The second stomach is called the Beis HaKosis, and that's what it was called originally. In Aramaic, it's called Beis Kasi. And it has the inside lining of it it looks like there's a bunch of indentations. They look like cups. That's why it's called Beis HaKosis. That's the second stomach of the animal. Then you have, through the long and the digestion process, there's the third stomach, which is called the liver. Now, the difference is the bakasi, the bakosis, has a very thick wall. So it's possible, for example, sometimes it happens that an animal swallows a needle or a nail or some such thing. They have even nowadays. It's one of the traits that they have to check for somewhat commonly when animals are fed in the outdoors, because sometimes they accidentally eat nails or other things that wind up in the ground over there. They call it hardware disease. The point is that you can have, the base mucosis has a relatively thick wall. You can have where a needle or a nail or what have you punctures one layer of it, but not the other layer. And then the animal is still kosher. Only if it gets punctured all the way through would it be changed. As opposed to the next stomach, which is called in Hebrew the hemsis, and here in the Gemara we're calling it huvlila, has a very thin wall relatively. So there, if you find a needle in it, If you find the needle in it, then there's really nothing to talk about. Once it punctured one layer, pretty much inevitably it punctured the other layer as well, and therefore it's going to be trimmed. That's how Rashi learned post this has a bit of a discussion about the pros and cons of that. Anyway, the point is, Abaya says the definitions of the names of those two stomachs have gotten switched around. What used to be called Hulila, which is the third stomach, is now called Bekasi. And what used to be called Bekasi, which was originally the second stomach, is now called Hulila, is now called by the name of the third one. So my opinion, what's the practical difference, is for this case, if you find the needle or something like that in the thickness of the wall of the Beis HaKosis, the Mitzad Echad Kshero Mishnei Tzadim Shreva, if you find it only puncturing through one layer of the wall, then the animal is still kosher because the contents of that stomach can't leak out into the body cavity. Or Mishnei Tzadim Shreva, but if you find that it went all the way through, then the animal is straight, and only by the Beis HaKosis do you have that definition, because the third stomach, the Huvlila, has a much thinner wall. So it's important to know what the names are. And then Rav Ashi says, "Ask Anu Noimar." We can also add a fifth thing where the names of things have been switched around. Bavel, Bursif, Bursif, Bavel. What used to be called Bavel is now called Bursif, and vice versa. What used to be called Bursif is now called Bavel. Lamayinaki. You know, the Gemara says, what's the practical necessity of knowing that detail? Is legitei noshin. Is as far as git. So Rashi brings two explanations about it. One explanation is that we know at the beginning of Gittin, the Mishnah and the Gemara talk about over there about the concept that usually I may be getting the Medina Sayyam, when a person brings a guest to Eretz Yisrael from overseas, from some foreign country, the people in those other countries are not so expert in the Gittin of writing Gittin, and therefore you need to be able to, for various reasons, the permission that the Gemara discusses over there, the Shliach needs to be able to say b'fanei nichta b'fanei nechtam, that this get was written and signed in my presence, and only then is it kosher to get. The Gemara mentions over there in Gittin that in Bavel, the people were expert enough in the Halacha, so they had many great yeshivas over there, so therefore it's not necessary to be able to say b'fanei nichta b'fanei nechtam when you're bringing a get from Bavel. However, Bursif is not like that. Bursif, what was originally called Bursif, is a place full of Amei Haaretz. So if you're bringing a get from Bursif, then you do need to be able to say b'fanei nechtam, b'fanei nechtam. So therefore, it's important to know that now the names have been switched around, and now it's the other way around. If you bring a get from Bursif, you don't have to say it. If you bring a get from Bavel, from what's now called Bavel, then you do need to. That's Rashi's first explanation. Then Rashi says another explanation is, when we say the gitin noshim, means as far as writing the proper name of the place in a get. We know that a get has to have, you have to write in a get, the name of the city where the get is being written. So therefore, it's important to know what the name of the city is, Bavel versus Bursif. If you write the wrong name, that's possible. Although Tosfos argues with that, because Bavel is actually the name of the country, not so much the name of the city. The city of Bavel, as we learned in Brachas, was destroyed and it's uninhabited. So we have to be talking about the country of Bavel. And in general, you don't write the name of a country in a get. You usually write the name of the city. You write the major water sources of the city. You know, there's a couple of cities nowadays where they write the name of the country or the name of the state that it's in order to distinguish them from other similarly named cities. But in general, you don't. In general, you just write the name of the city and then the name of its water sources. So therefore, Tosfos says, better we should stick with Rashi's first explanation that we're talking about Rufani Nechtam, because it doesn't matter about the name of the country, because you're anyway, or the province or whatever, because you're anyway not writing that in the game. This next parak that we're going to start now, the third parak of Shabbos, is the first half of it anyway, is the first four or five blocks of it, are going to be talking about a concept which we touched on before. We touched on it in the first and the second parak, but now we're going to get into it in a lot of detail. This is these are the concepts of leaving food on Shabbos to stay warm. Now you have, there's a few different possibilities of it here, and we're going to be dealing with all of them. There's what's called shehiya, when you want to leave a pot on the fire when Shabbos comes in. You have hatmana, which is where you're insulating a pot, like wrapping it up in something or covering it with something that will keep it warm. And then you have chazora, which is where you took something off the fire on Shabbos and you want to be able to put it back on the fire. Or Tosfos actually discusses over here the possibility that there might even be an issue with Chazorah right before Shabbos, but anyway, we'll get into that. So now all of those things, all of that concept really only exists at Abonim. Midaraisa, okay, we had a machlokes the Shama Behillo in the first parak, whether you're allowed to begin a malacha before Shabbos and have it continue on Shabbos. It's called the concept of Shvisas Kalim. We said in the end over there that the Shammai hold of Shvisas Kalim and the Tilol does not. The halacha, of course, is like the Tilol. So on a Daraisa level, there should be no problem leaving a pot of food on the stove before Shabbos, or there should be no problem leaving it on there or insulating it. But in the Rabbanan, we make various rules on that because of the problem that we've discussed before, Shema Yechate B'Gecholim. Because you might have, the person may stir up the coals in order to keep the food warmer, in order to heat up the food further. So therefore, the Chachamim made various rules about Shehiyah and Chazara and Hatmana. Now, Rashi actually learns that everything that we're going to be learning over here about Shehiyah, we're going to be focusing, at least at the beginning, on Shehiyah. Rashi learns that everything we're going to be learning about it is really just an outgrowth of the Dinim of Hatmana. Because we said that you're not allowed, we learned previously a few blocks ago that you're not allowed, that midrabanan, you're not allowed to do hatsmana, you're not allowed to do insulation with something that is moisif hevel, with something that adds heat. Therefore, as part of that, the Muhammad made the rule of shahiyah that depending on the circumstances, you can't keep a pot of food on the fire coming into Shabbos, because obviously that adds heat to it. Pretty much all the other Rishonim disagree with Rashi on that, starting with Tosfos over here, and say that no, Hatmana is when you have the food on various grounds, one of them being that we mentioned before that ashes that contain coals in them are considered Dover HaMosef Hevel, but you were going to say that if you cover the coals with ashes, then you're allowed to. So for that and many other reasons, most of them disagree with Rashi and say that no, Hatmana, and in fact, the Baal HaMor actually says, where did Rashi get this idea from? Because we mentioned Hatmana at the end of the second parak, we said the Tonin of Hachamin, the fourth parak is also going to be talking about Hatmana, so therefore Rashi assumes, says the Baal HaMor, that here also we're talking about something which is an outgrowth of Hatmana. But Tosfos and the Razah, and pretty much everybody else disagrees with Rashi on that, and says, no, those are two different things. Hatmana refers to when you have the pot completely covered or mostly covered by the insulating material. Here we're talking about putting a pot on top of a stove, and it might not even be touching the coals per se, because, for example, you could have it on a tripod or something. So note, these dinim that we're talking about, shahiyah, are something completely different. The Chachamim were concerned that if you leave a pot on the stove, depending on the circumstances, then you might come to stir up the coals and try to heat it up on Shabbos. Okay. So let's start out. The Mishnah says, we do have to mention, by the way, that a lot of what we're going to be learning over here and over these next couple of days, there are a lot of different opinions of the Shonim and Achronim on various details of them, and a lot of that, of course, affects the actual practical halacha, so we'll see what we can do as far as explaining it and then clarifying it as much as possible. So the Mishnah says, Kira. A Kira is like this. Rashi describes, it looks like a big pot where they put smaller pots into it. It itself, a kira, consists kind of thing. Usually it would be made out of earthenware. It's rectangular. It's the same width at the bottom and at the top, and that's important because that makes it different than a tanner, than an oven, which they had in those days. So it's shaped like a rectangular box, and you have on the top of it two holes on which you can put pots. So either sometimes they would put pots inside it, but sometimes they would put pots. They lower the pot down through the hole, and it's sitting directly on top of the coals or whatever inside the kira. Sometimes you would have the pot sits on top of the kira, on top of the hole, and there might be like projections or whatever sticking out around the hole in order for the pot to stay on top of that, and then it would cook from the fire underneath. So that's what a kira is. Now the point is, because a kira is rectangular, because it's the same width at the top and at the bottom, and because it has those two big holes, therefore, relatively speaking, it doesn't hold that much heat. While it's being fired up, while you have a fire burning in it, of course, it gets very hot, but it doesn't retain its heat as much as we're going to talk about later on in the parak. We're going to talk about an oven, which is narrower on top, and therefore it retains its heat much better. So the Mishnah says, Kira Shesi Korba Kashel Vava. If you fired a kira, this two-pot stove, using straw, specifically Rashi says that straw means the tops of the stalks of grain. So like you have when you harvest grain, you have the part of the straw that you harvest together with the grain, and then you have the part. Then you have the part that stays attached to the ground. Rashi learns that tash is the top part. Tosfos says the other way around. It means the bottom part. Anyway, whatever it is, it's very insubstantial stuff because it's straw, or the gvava, or the stubble that's left over in the field. So according to Rashi, tash is the top part, gvava is the bottom part of the stalk. According to Tosfos, it's the other way around. Whatever. The point is, those burn up very easily. Therefore, you're allowed to put a pot of food on such a kira coming into Shabbat, and there's no problem because the Chachamim are not concerned that you're going to try to stir up the coals, because there really aren't any coals. There's not really straw, and stubble burn very quickly. There's really nothing left of them by the time you're done. So therefore, there's not really going to be any coals to stir up, so the Chachamim aren't concerned about that. But the Gethes of the Aitin, but if you fired up this kira using Gethes, which is the leftovers of, Rashi says, of sesame seeds, it can also be of olives, of various other things, where you press out oil, and of course there is a fair amount of oil left in the pulp afterwards, so you can use that as fire, it's good firewood, and it does produce coal, over etzim, or with wood, which also produces coal, then you have a problem where there are going to be coals left, and you're going to try to stir them up on Shabbos, therefore, lo yisim, therefore you're not allowed to put a pot of food on the fire for Shabbos. Add to Yigros, unless you rake out the coals before Shabbos. Unless you spread ashes on top of the coals, because then that way, by putting ashes, that helps. It helps start cooling them off. It shows that you're not intending to, you don't care if the coals stay hot. Nowadays, by the way, when we put on a blech on the stove, that's pretty much what's accomplished over here by putting on ashes. This thing that we're mentioning over here, Shigigroi for Shigitin, that's the Afer, this is, we're going to be referring in the Gemara over and over to what's called Goruf V'Kotum, or Grufa Uktuma. Goruf means that the ashes, that the coals were raked out. Kotum means, the word Kitma is the Aramaic word for ashes, so Kotum means that you put ashes on top of the coals. So our missionary is telling us that if you have a kira that was heated up using gethes, using sesame seed pulp or olive pulp or whatever, or wood, then in order to be able to put a pot on there for Shabbos, you have to make it goruf for kotum. You have to either rake out the coals that are there, or you have to put a layer of ashes on top of the coals, and then you'd be allowed to put a pot there on Shabbos. Once you've done that, once you've made it goruf v'kotum, then Beit Shammai says you can put hot water on there to keep to be hot for Shabbos, because there's only so much that you need to boil water. Once it's boiled, so there's no problem that you might wait. Now, you have to realize, even when you do goro for kutum, it's impossible to get out every last coal from there. When you do goro, when you rake out the coals, inevitably there are going to be a few coals left. So therefore, and we're going to deal with this in the Gemara, that there's always a possibility that they might try to stir up those few coals that are left. So the Shammai says that at most you're allowed to keep hot water on there, because then we're not fine, even though there are maybe a few coals left over, we're not so worried about that you're going to try to rake them up, because how much do you need to boil water already? And we also have to distinguish, but okay, you know what, that's that, we'll get to see. But I have a light tab show, but not a cooked dish, because there you may come to rake the coals, or Rashi says another reason, because he actually accomplished what he wanted to. He wants to cook it, so therefore it looks like he's cooking on Shabbos, and Beit Shammai has a problem with that. Or Rassilo and Chanan in the tavshil. Rassilo says there's no problem. You can put hot water or a tavshil over there. Beit Shammai in a note when Abba Lema did, when you take it off the fire, Beit Shammai says you're only allowed to take it off the fire. You're not allowed under any circumstances to put it back on the fire on Shabbos. Or not the fire, on the stove, which doesn't have any coals in it, because you raked out the coals or you covered them with ashes. Still, Beit Shammai is saying you're not allowed to return a pot of food onto the stove over there, because it still looks like you're cooking on Shabbos. Or Beit Shammai, Matmach Sidin, Beit Shammai says you're even allowed to return the pot of food to there on Shabbos, because once you raked out the coals or banked them with ashes, then the civil says there's no problem returning food to there. Tosfos actually learns over here that if you didn't do goruf b'kotum, then it would be a problem not only to put it on Shabbos, it would be a problem even to put it there before Shabbos, because if you put it there right before Shabbos, it's still going to be cooking on Shabbos, and you have a problem that it looks like cooking. Okay. So now we've introduced the basic things that we're going to be dealing with the next few days about shehiyah, we haven't really gotten into shehiyah so much, but okay, you know what, let's learn the Gemara, then we'll be a little more clear.
What about now Shabbos? We put a blach on. You think you're cooking also.
So that's what I'm saying. A blach is basically the equivalent of putting aether, or putting ashes. So you're putting ashes on top of the coals, and that demonstrates, therefore, that you don't care for them to be so hot, and therefore there's no concern that you're going to go rake them. By the way, the poskim say that. Now I mentioned before there's a difference between a kira, which is the two burner stove that we're talking about over here, versus a tanner, which is an oven, which is narrower on top. Now our ovens nowadays are not built like the ovens they had in those times. They don't open from the top; they open from the side. The poskim say that the kind of ovens we have nowadays that open from the side are considered like the kira of our Mishnah. They're not considered; they don't retain their heat so much, not as a tanner, which has only a small opening on the top. Therefore, the same dinim that we're saying that apply over here to a kira would apply to our modern day ovens. It also applies not only when they're wood fired, like old style ovens, but also nowadays electric or gas or what have you ovens. The same basic dinim applies. And yes, when we put on a blech, then that's the equivalent of shiyitin at the acre, when you put ashes in to bank the fire, and then that's allowed. But now we have to get into the details and get into the specifics. One other thing we need to mention, which is going to be important later on, is within a tavshil, we're mentioning over here water versus a pot of food, there's a difference between different kinds of pots of food. Because later on, we're going to learn about the distinction between what's called mitstamek v'yofeloi or mitstamek v'raloi. Mitstamek means that it shrivels. Like, imagine, you know how when you put food on the stove, and as it keeps on cooking, it shrivels, it shrinks, it gets smaller and smaller. Now, you have certain kinds of things that are mitstamek v'yofeloi. You have certain kinds of things where the longer they stay on the fire, the better they are. And therefore, there's more of a concern that you may stir up the coals in order to heat them up. On the other hand, you have things that are mitstamek v'raloi. You have certain things where once they've reached a certain point of cooking, if they cook any more and they keep on shrinking, they're bad. You don't want it to be. Water actually is one example of that, because once the water is boiled, there's no benefit to it boiling anymore, and all you have is boiling more and more wet. So we're going to see later on, there's a distinction when we talk about pots of food on the stove, there's going to be this different, there's going to be this distinction between the stomach, the yopalai, and the stomach viralai. But, okay, let's start the Gemara. Now we have a question. We said in the Mishnah that if you fired up the kira using straw, then there's no problem, then you don't need goat for kachum. But we said if you fired it using gefes or wood, sesame seed pulp or wood, then you need to do goat for kachum. And we said that unless you do that lo yitin, you can't put a pot of food on it. So by the way, high lo yitin. What does it mean lo yitin? What does it mean exactly? Are we talking about putting it on Shabbos, or are we talking about putting it there before Shabbos and staying there? Is hay lo yitin lo yachdehu? Does the word lo yitin mean you're not allowed to return it to the fire on Shabbos? Aval lishoy, lishahoy, actually. But if you're talking about leaving it there on the fire from before Shabbos, machine, then you would be allowed to do that even after any gorof for any kotum. Then you would say that you would be allowed to do even if it wasn't gorof for kotum. Umani Hanani, in which case we would say that our Mishnah follows the opinion of Hanania, the Tanya, Hanania Omer, kosher to Michael Bendrasoi, once the food is already cooked to the extent of Michael Bendrasoi, which we talked about at the end of the first paragraph, the Macholikus, a post-skim, whether the Macholikus is showing whether it's a half-cooked or a third-cooked, whatever, Hanania says once it's reached that point, then we're not so worried that you're going to stir up the coal to cook it all the way. Therefore, he says, Mutu l'shahoyse agabe kira apapisha ene gorof fe ene kotum. So then he says you would be allowed to leave that pot on the stove, even though it's not gorof for kotum, even though you haven't raked out the coals or banked it with ashes. So in that case, then our Mishnah, if we say that our Mishnah goes up Hanania, then the Mishnah would mean, when it says Lo Yitin, it's not talking about putting a pot of food on there before Shabbos. It's talking about if you have the pot on there before Shabbos, and then you took it off during Shabbos to serve the food, now are you allowed to put it back there? So Hanania would say, to put it back, it has to be Gorof for kachum. Or maybe not. Maybe the Mishnah is actually talking about leaving it on the fire before Shabbos. And the e gorof for kotum ein eloi loi, and only then if it's gorof for kotum would you be allowed to leave it on there before Shabbos to do shahia. If not, then not. But kosher came after. And then you would say how much more so then the Mishnah would be saying that to return the food onto there on Shabbos would be even more of a problem if it's not gorof for kotum, because returning it is more of a problem. First of all, returning it takes place on Shabbos itself. So therefore, it looks much more, it's much more of an issue that you might stir up the coals on Shabbos as opposed to before it. Second of all, it looks like cooking. And in fact, in some cases, I mean, there is a concept in halacha called ein bishul acha bishul, but the details of that are themselves a little bit complicated when we say ein bishul acha bishul when not. We're going to discuss a little bit of it in our parrot of these concepts when we say that once something is cooked, then it can't be cooked again la halacha. And the Alter Rebbe, for example, mentions in Hilchos Adam Kol Shabbos that if you have, the general rule is in bishul acha bishul, the dover yavish, with something dry, then there's no bishul acha bishul. However, if, for example, some of it melts, like, for example, you know, you have your warm-up chicken, for example, and some of the fats or some of the juices or whatever melt out of it, then you do have an issue. You do have an issue with bishul acha bishul. So then you'd have more of a problem with returning it to the fire on Shabbos, because then you have more of a real problem of that you're going to be doing bishul. So therefore, again, if we say that the Mishnah is talking about Chazara, then the Mishnah, which is according to Hanania, then we would be saying Shehiyah, there's no problem to leave it on there, even if it's not Gorof for Kotum, the problem is only Chazara. And the law you said of our Mishnah would mean Chazara. Or does our Mishnah mean that both of them would be a problem if the oven is not, if the stove is not Gorof for Kotum? So which is it? So the Gemara says, Toshma, Midikotoni Tre Bobi B'Masitin. Well, let's look more carefully. We have two sections of our Mishnah. First, after we presented the basic thing about the basic thing over there, about we have this kira, we have the two different kinds of materials, or the four different kinds of materials that it could have been fired with. And we said, after that, we had two things in the Mishnah. We had two machlokes in Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. We said the Shama and Ruchamin Avaloi Tavshil, the Silla and Ruchamin Tavshil. Number one, that the Shama and the Silla argue whether you're only allowed to do this with hot water or also with a pot of food. The Shama says only hot water, and the Silla says also a pot of food. And then also the Shama and Nertlan Avaloi Mazirin, or the Silla and Atmazirin. Then we had a second machlokes, where the Shama says you can only take the pot off the fire on Shabbos if it's goder for kutum, but not to put it back. Or with Hillel and Achmat Yirin, and then the Hillel says you're allowed to put back the pot also. So let's figure that out. Iyam at the Shlema l'shahos tnan. If you say the second possibility that we were talking about, that our Mishnah is not according to Hananya, that our Mishnah is according to the Chachamim who argue with Hananya, well then hachi katani. Then we understand there are two separate cases in our Mishnah. Let's reread the Mishnah. Hachi katani. Then the Mishnah is going like this: Kirashi tikor b'kashu v'gava mashina le'atavshel. If it was fired with straw or with stubble, then you're allowed to leave a pot of food on it. The guess of Eitim, but if it was fired using sesame seed pulp or wood, lo yasher, then you're not allowed to leave food on there going into Shabbos. Ad sheyigros by ad sheyitaneper, unless you rake out the coals, unless you previously rake out the coals or cover them with ashes. Umahen mashin, and when we're talking about when the fire is goreh for kutum, when you rake out the coals or covered them with ashes, what kinds of things would you be allowed to put on top of such a kira? That the shana would say only hot water, and the silla says also a dish of food. And then we would say then on top of that, the same argument that they have as far as Shahia, they would also have as far as returning the pot after you took it off the fire on Shabbos, where should it Shama and Nertlan of Lama Lirin, or Bitsilah and Ahmad Lirin, where Bitsilah says you could take it off, but you can't put it back, and Bitsilah says you can't, and Bitsilah says that you could even put it back. That you could put it back even on Shabbos. So if we understand that the Mishnah is first introducing the question of whether you can do Shehiya or not, then we understand. We have two machlokes in the Shama and the Silla, one about Shehiya and one about Chazarah. But if you say that the whole thing the Mishnah is first introducing is the whole matter of Chazarah, then how does the Mishnah go? Let's learn the Mishnah according to that possibility. If we say the Mishnah goes according to Hananya, and Shehiya is allowed, no problem, whether you get Gorah for Kotim or not, only Chazorah is the problem, then let's reread the Mishnah. Hachi Katani. Then how does the Mishnah go? Kirashi tikor v'kashu v'gava machzirin aleo tavshu. When we say in the Mishnah, noisin aleo tavshu, according to Hananya, again, we're saying it means machzirin aleo. We should be allowed to return the pot of food to it on Shabbos, if it was fired up with straw, because again, then you don't need goreh for kutum, because again, nothing is left after you burn straw or stubble. Therefore, there's not really anything that we're worried about that you're going to try to stir up. But guess this, so the Eitim, if it was using sesame seed pulp or wood, lo yachzir, we would be saying in the Mishnah that you can't return the pot of food today on Shabbos, achi yigurus, achi yitanefer, unless you previously rake out the coals or cover them with ashes. Then we would continue. Again, if we say that the Mishnah is so far talking only about Chazorah, then we would say, what are you allowed to return to the fire on Shabbos? The Shama would say only hot water, not a cooked dish. The Silla would say also a cooked dish, also a pot of food. Well, then, the question is, so far so good. But then if we continue in the Mishnah, that Shama Omer knows the Nabalot Nabazirin, and still Omer Ach Machzirin, if then we say that Shama says you're allowed to take it off the fire and not put it back, and the Silla says you're even allowed to put it back, and there obviously we're talking about a pot of food, because the Shama allowed you in the first part of the Mishnah, according to the way we're understanding it now, the Shama is allowing you to put back a pot of hot water. So then in that case, how true lovely. We already said that Shammai says you're not allowed to put back a pot of food. What is that last machlokes is adding when it says no Nabalot Machzirin? So wouldn't that mean that the Mishnah therefore has to be talking about Shehiya and not about and implicitly also about Chazorah, which would mean according to Chachamim, not according to Hananya? And in that case, then fine. The Mishnah is first telling us about Shehiya, and then telling us, by the way, you should know that Shama and Silo have the same machlokas as far as Chazara. But if you said to begin with, the Mishnah is talking about Chazara, then what is the last part adding to us?
Excuse me, I forgot what Shia means.
Shia means leaving the pot of food on the fire before Shabbos.
Oh, okay.
So that pretty much, basically what we do now, what we do nowadays with a blech. When we put on a blech before Shabbos, we leave a pot on the stove before Shabbos, that's accomplishing, that's called Shehiyah. Okay. So the question is, therefore, so doesn't that imply that we have to understand, the Mishnah the second way, meaning not like Hananya? So we're not only talking about Chazara, we're talking primarily about Shehiyah, we're talking primarily about the question, are you allowed to leave a pot on the stove coming into Shabbos? And then, as a side thing, we'd be mentioning, by the way, once we're mentioning that, then you should know that there's machlokas as far as putting a pot back onto the stove on Shabbos as well. Okay. So the Gemara says no. La'olam emolach lahachvitznan. Actually, we could even say that our Mishnah is primarily talking about the question of Chazara, which would mean, therefore, that the Mishnah is saying that Shehiyah is not really a problem, even if you didn't do Gerdus for Kofim, even if you didn't sweep out the coals or cover them with ashes. The Mishnah might still be implying that there's no problem, even if you use Gefes or Eitim for the fire, even though those produce coals. Shehiyah, like Hananiah says, wouldn't be a problem once the food is already at Michael Ben Rasoi. So we could say the Mishnah is missing words. You could say the Mishnah means as follows. Again, if you use straw to fire it up, then you're allowed to put back the pot of food on here on Shabbos. The Gefes of Eitim, but if you use sesame seed pulp or wood, which produced cold, lo yachzir, we're not allowing you to return the pot to the fire on Shabbos ad yigrei, unless you first rake out the cold, or unless you put ashes on the cold, because otherwise, again, we're concerned that you're going to try to stir up the cold in order to heat it up better, because after all, you took it off the fire and now you're putting it back. But here's the part the Mishnah is missing that we're adding in. But when it comes to leaving food on the fire coming into Shabbos, Mashahin, you would be allowed to do that on Shabbos, even if the coals have not been swept out, or even if the coals have not been covered with ashes, because we would be going according to Hananiah, who allows that as long as the food was already at Michael Ben Rusai. Umahe Meshahin, and then we would ask the question, so in that case, if we're saying that Shehiyah is allowed on a stove that still has the coals inside it and that hasn't been covered with ashes, then you have the question, what kind of things are you allowed to leave on such a stove? Then Bishama would say only hot water, not a dish of food, not a pot of food, or and the Silla would say both of them. And now, going back to earlier in the Mishnah, you would say, Bahach Chazara de Amilach, when we talked about earlier in the Mishnah that you're allowed to do Chazara, even when you use Gethas and Asin, even when you didn't rake out the coals or cover them with ashes, you should know, Lav Divrei Hakovi, the Mishnah would be saying, this is not according to everybody. Ela Machloikas Vishamai Basil. You should know that it is actually a Machloikas Bet Shammai and Bet Silul, namely, Shabbat Shammai and Lothman below Masirin, because actually Bet Shammai would say that you're not allowed to do Chazara on such a stove unless you made it Gorof for Kotum, or Bet Silul and Mach Masirin, and Bet Silul would be saying that you would be allowed to put the food on there, on Shabbos, if it was made with straw, or it was made with the other things, if they were Gorof for Kotum, the Shammai would still say, fine, Shehiyah I'm going to allow you, but only hot water. And as far as returning it, that not at all, not even hot water, they would say, could you do Chazara on Shabbos? Whereas the Tzilla would say you couldn't. So if we understand the Mishnah that way, then it could still go according to Hananiah. Now, we're going to continue the discussion tomorrow, Beis Hashem, but so far, we have to ask the question, who is the halacha like? Is it like Hananiah or is it like the Chachamim? So the answer is that you actually have a machlokas rishonim on that. The Rif and the Rambam and some other rishonim passed in like the Chachamim, not like Hananiah, on the basis of their analysis of the Gemara over here. On the other hand, Tosfos mentions over here that the reason why the Gemara is trying so hard to make our Mishnah work according to Hananiah is because the halacha is like Hananiah. The halacha is like Hananiah, so therefore you would therefore the Gemara would prefer to make the Mishnah work according to him. So you actually have those two different opinions of the Rishonim, and you have it's brought in Shulchan Aruch both opinions. Although the Alter Rebbe says the minhag is like the other Poskim who hold like Tosfos and the other Rishonim who hold that the halacha is like Hananiah, which of course results in a great kula. It would mean therefore that shehiya, meaning leaving a pot of food on the stove before Shabbos, as long as it was Michael Bender's story before Shabbos, then there would be no problem. You would be able to leave them on the stove before Shabbos, even if you didn't do Goda for Kutum, or in nowadays, even if you didn't put down a blech. As opposed to, according to the Rif and the Rambam and so forth, you would say that even if the food is Michael Bender's story, then you would still need to have Goda for Kutum if you want to leave the food on the stove for Shabbos. So that's the gist of the din. I mean, you have again we'll learn tomorrow and we'll learn over the next couple of days. That's the shem. We'll talk about again the distinction between different kinds of things that you might leave on the stove. In particular, the distinction that I mentioned before between the stomach betovloy and the yotaloy and the stomach beraloy, whether the longer you leave it on the stove and the more it shrinks from the heat, the better it gets versus not, that also makes a difference when you're allowed to leave it on the stove, when you're allowed to leave it on the stove with no problem versus when you're only allowed to leave it if it's goda for kutum or in modern terms, if you put a blech. So we'll talk about that tomorrow and the next couple of days, that's the general.
So normally with a blech, once you take it off, and you're supposed to put it back unless you're keeping it partially on the blech, and two people are moving it together, one person's holding it, touching the blech,
we're going to talk about that point, about Chazara, we're going to talk about that on Daf Lamed Ches, so a couple of days from now, but Beis Hashem, we'll get into the details of those.
Right. Well, I'm not saying a crackpot on a clock, on a Shabbos clock. Let's say I had the crackpot going Yom Kippur, and then it went on... It went on Friday afternoon. If it goes on, let's say, and it's not enough time for the food to be, but it's on, and you know, it went on by itself, and it continues going. Is there a problem with eating that type of child?
I don't know, actually. That would probably be something to ask the Rav. I mean, I guess part of the question is whether the crock pot itself is considered to be on a blech. I mean, very commonly, what you do with a crock pot or something like that, you're lining it with silver foil.
Yeah, it is lined with silver foil.
I suppose that functions as the equivalent of a blech, but I don't know exactly.
I suspect that's
exactly what it is. You line it with silver foil precisely so that it serves as an hector, so it serves as a thing to demonstrate that you're not planning to adjust it or whatever on Shabbos, and therefore such a thing is likely to be allowed. But I mean, if you saw your parents doing it, that's probably a pretty good source in itself. But
my question is myself: if I get cooked enough on Friday, the challenge, that when it went into Shabbos Friday night, that it was cooked enough that it didn't, you know, it wasn't raw.
One thing is you have like this. We did learn in the first parak about the concept called kedera chaisa. If you're talking about something that contains meat and it's completely raw when Shabbos comes in, then it's also allowed because we talked about over there, then you're not, given that it's completely raw coming into Shabbos, it's obviously not going to be cooked by Friday night enough for you, by the time you sit down for your Shabbos meal Friday night, it's not going to be cooked enough to be able to eat it. So then also the Chachamim are less concerned that you're going to stir up the cold because there's no sense in it. They're going to turn up the heat nowadays or whatever because there's no sense in it. It's not going to be ready in time anyway. The problem is if it's between raw and Michael Bender's story, that's where you have the problem.
Uh-huh. Okay. But if it's something that if it's the child that wasn't, when I put it up Friday afternoon, I wasn't planning to eat till Shabbos afternoon, like today.
It's not so much what you're planning to, it's not so much what you're planning to, it's when you put it up. Was there enough time? I mean, the truth is, today having been Yom Tov, and not that, whatever, Friday having been Yom Tov, you have a different issue, actually. You have to put it up with enough time. You actually have to. I mean, even an Erev HaShulchan only allows you to prepare on Shabbos for Yom Tov, but there still has to be the possibility that you could have Hanah from it on Friday. So actually, in that case, you do have to put it up early enough that you have, that in principle, it could be cooked. At least Kamaichal Ben Rasoi before Shabbos, and you would be able to eat it in principle.
Got it. But you have to be able to eat it by the day that you make it, okay?
It doesn't have to be that you actually eat it, but it has to be that you could have eaten it. But on a regular Friday, right, if you put it in a minute or two before Shabbos, and it's still raw, when Shabbos begins, then there's also less of an issue even if there's no blech, because then again, the Chachamim are not really concerned that you're going to try to stir up or mix anything to make it cook faster, because realistically you're not going to have it ready for tonight anyway. The problem comes in more when it's between completely raw and Michael Ben Rasoi. That's when I'm talking about meat, and we're talking about other kinds of foods we'll talk about in the Gemara later. Then it's a little more complicated, because then even with certain other kinds of foods, even when they're raw, they're still edible. So then you still might have a problem, that even though, not so much that they're edible when they're raw, although there is that, more that they don't take as long as meats to cook. Let's say, for example, you're cooking vegetables, those cook fairly quickly. So those, even if they're raw when Shabbos comes in, you have a problem, because you might easily try to raise the temperature to get them cooking in time, and in time for you to be able to eat them tonight, because it's not like meat where it takes hours for it to be ready.
Right.
So those are the basics. I mean, like I said, there's a lot of complicated dinim in this, and I don't think we're going to be able to get into all the complications over the next couple of days. The truth of the matter is I'm not 100% clear on all those complications myself. But we'll see what we can do.
The accepted definition of machol ben rusay is 2/3 or 1/3.
No. You have a machlokes. Of course, whether it's 1/3 or 1/2. Well, so you have two different opinions, so you have to go according to whichever one results in a chumrah. Rashi defines that it's 1/3. The Rambam defines that it's 1/2. So when it comes to these dinim, you'd have to be machmer appropriately. Yeah.
So anything less than machal ben rusay, whatever the definition, is asur.
No, so that's the thing. So it depends. If we're talking about meat or something that contains meat, then it's actually mutter, because meat doesn't cook that quickly. So therefore, we're talking about pots containing meat. We're not talking about, for example, roasting meat or whatever, because roasting goes fairly quickly. So then this dispensation doesn't apply to that. But let's say, for example, you have a pot of challah or a pot of soup, whatever, with meat in it. If you put it up right before Shabbos and it's still completely raw, then you don't have as much of an issue with leaving it to cook, because then again, Chachamim are not really concerned that you're going to try to hurry up the cooking of it, because it's not going to be ready in time anyway.
Even if you don't hurry up, it's still cooking on Shabbos, because it's just raw right before Shabbos.
That's fine. We said the halacha is not like the Shammai. We said that the Shvitas Kalim is not an issue on Shabbos. So in and of itself, the fact that it's cooking on Shabbos isn't as much of an issue, although sometimes it is. I mean, depending on the circumstances. Again, you have a lot of details and counter details and whatever about this in Shulchan Aruch, where sometimes we are concerned about the appearance of that you're cooking on Shabbos. So there is that factor as well, yeah.
Blech definitely takes away the problem.
Blech takes away a lot of that idea, right? A lot of that problem, because then it demonstrates, therefore, that you're not interested in the fire getting any hotter on Shabbos, and therefore there's less of a concern that you're going to stir it or whatever in order to get.
Okay, where are we learning Chabad?
So let's see.
What's good for you, Rabbi?